Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Greatest Evil is War by Chris Hedges, narrated by Eunice Wong. Everything created by violence is senseless and useless. It exists without a future. It will leave no trace. Vasily Grossman. 1. The Greatest Evil is War. Preemptive war, whether in Iraq or Ukraine, is a war crime. It does not matter if the war is launched on the basis of lies and fabrications, as was the case in Iraq, or because of the breaking of a series of agreements with Russia, including the promise by Washington not to extend NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, not to deploy thousands of NATO troops in Central and Eastern Europe, and not to meddle in the internal affairs of nations on Russia's border, as well as the refusal to implement the Minsk peace agreement. The invasion of Ukraine would, I expect, never have happened if these promises had been kept. Russia has every right to feel threatened, betrayed, and angry. But to understand is not to condone. The invasion of Ukraine under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. I know the instrument of war. War is not politics by other means. It is demonic. I spent 2 decades as a war correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. I carry within me the ghosts of dozens of those swallowed up in the violence, including my close friend, Reuters correspondent Kirk Shork, who was killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno de Mora. I know the chaos and disorientation of war, the constant uncertainty and confusion. In a firefight, you are only aware of what is happening a few feet around you. You desperately, and not always successfully, struggle to figure out where the firing is coming from to avoid being hit. I have felt the helplessness and paralyzing fear, which, years later, descend on me like a freight train in the middle of the night, leaving me wrapped in coils of terror, my heart racing, my body dripping with sweat. I have heard the wails of those convulsed by grief as they clutch the bodies of friends and family, including children. I hear them still. It does not matter the language. Spanish, Arabic, Hebrew, Dinka, Serbo-Croatian, Albanian, Ukrainian, Russian. Death cuts through the linguistic barriers. I know what wounds look like. Legs blown off, heads imploded into a bloody, pulpy mass, gaping holes in stomachs, pools of blood, cries of the dying, sometimes for their mothers. And the smell of death, the supreme sacrifice made for flies and maggots. I was beaten by Iraqi and Saudi secret police. I was taken prisoner by the Contras in Nicaragua, who radioed back to their base in Honduras to see if they should kill me, and again in Basra after the first Gulf War in Iraq, never knowing if I would be executed, under constant guard and often without food, drinking out of mud puddles. The primary lesson in war is that we as distinct individuals do not matter. We become numbers, fodder, objects. Life, once precious and sacred, becomes meaningless, sacrificed to the insatiable appetite of Mars. No one in wartime is exempt. We were expendable, Eugene Sledge wrote of his experiences as a Marine in the South Pacific in World War II. It was difficult to accept. We come from a nation and a culture that values life and the individual. To find oneself in a situation where your life seems of little value is the ultimate in loneliness. It is a humbling experience. Sledge recalls a young Marine officer who had one ghoulish, obscene tendency of urinating into the mouths of Japanese corpses. The landscape of war is hallucinogenic. Sledge calls it the kaleidoscope of the unreal. It defies comprehension. War, like the Holocaust, as Barbara Foley wrote, is unknowable. Its full dimensions are inaccessible to the ideological framework that we have inherited from the liberal era. You have no concept of time in a firefight. A few minutes, a few hours. War, in an instant, obliterates homes and communities, all that was once familiar. and leaves behind smoldering ruins and a trauma that you carry for the rest of your life. I have tasted enough of war, enough of my own fear, my body turned to jelly, to know that war is always evil, the purest expression of death, dressed up in patriotic cant about liberty and democracy, and sold to the naive as a ticket to glory, honor, and courage. It is a toxic and seductive elixir. Those who survive, as Kurt Vonnegut wrote, struggle afterwards to reinvent themselves and their universe, which, on some level, will never make sense again. Walt Whitman, who tended wounded soldiers in hospitals during the Civil War, wrote in a heading in his notebook, "The real war will never get in the books. Its interior history will not only never be written," Whitman argues, "its practicality, minutiae of deeds and passions will never be even suggested." War destroys all systems that sustain and nurture life, familial, economic, cultural, political, environmental, and social. Once war begins, no one, even those nominally in charge of waging war, knows what will happen, how the war will develop, how it can drive armies and nations towards suicidal folly. There are no good wars. None. This includes World War II, which has been sanitized and mythologized to celebrate American heroism, purity, and goodness. If truth is the first casualty in war, ambiguity is the second. The bellicose rhetoric embraced and amplified by the American press, demonizing Vladimir Putin and elevating the Ukrainians to the status of demigods, demanding more robust military intervention, along with the crippling sanctions designed to bring down Putin's government, is infantile and dangerous. That the inverse version of the conflict is true in the Russian media fuels the insanity. There were no discussions about pacifism in the basements in Sarajevo when we were being hit with hundreds of Serbian shells a day and under constant sniper fire. It made sense to defend the city. It made sense to kill or be killed. The Bosnian Serb soldiers in the Drina Valley, Vukovar, and Srebrenica had amply demonstrated their capacity for murderous rampages, including the gunning down of hundreds of soldiers and civilians, and the wholesale rape of women and girls. But this did not save any of the defenders in Sarajevo from the poison of violence, the soul-destroying force that is war. I knew a Bosnian soldier who heard a sound behind a door while patrolling on the outskirts of Sarajevo. He fired a burst from his AK-47 through the door. A delay of a few seconds in combat can mean death. When he opened the door, he found the bloody remains of a 12-year-old girl. His daughter was 12. He never recovered. 2. Chronicle of a War Foretold. I was in Central and Eastern Europe in 1989, reporting on the revolutions that overthrew the ossified communist dictatorships that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was a time of hope. NATO, with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, became obsolete. President Mikhail Gorbachev reached out to Washington and Europe to build a new security pact that would include Russia, perhaps one that would lead to joining NATO. Secretary of State James Baker in the Reagan administration, along with West German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, assured the Soviet leader that if Germany was unified, NATO would not be extended beyond the new borders. The commitment not to expand NATO, also made by Great Britain and France, appeared to herald a new global order. We saw the peace dividend dangled before us, the promise that the massive expenditures on weapons that characterized the Cold War would be converted into expenditures on social programs and infrastructures that had long been neglected to feed the insatiable appetite of the military. There was a near universal understanding among diplomats and political leaders at the time that any attempt to expand NATO was foolish, an unwarranted provocation against Russia that would obliterate the ties and bonds that happily emerged at the end of the Cold War. How naive we were. The war industry did not intend to shrink its power or its profits. It set out, almost immediately, to recruit the former communist bloc countries into the European Union and NATO. Countries that joined NATO which now include Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia, were forced to reconfigure their militaries, often through hefty loans, to become compatible with NATO military hardware. The steady shipments of European and U.S. weapons into Ukraine were turning the country, despite Russian protests, into a de facto NATO member. There would be no peace dividend. The expansion of NATO swiftly became a multi-billion-dollar bonanza for the corporations that had profited from the Cold War. Poland, for example, in a recent arms deal, will spend $6 billion on M1 Abrams tanks and other U.S. military equipment. If Russia would not acquiesce to again being the enemy, then Russia would be pressured into becoming the enemy. And here we are, on the brink of another Cold War, one from which only the war industry will profit, while, as W.H. Auden wrote, the little children died in the streets. The consequences of pushing NATO up to the borders with Russia, there is now a NATO missile base in Poland 100 miles from the Russian border, were well known to policymakers. Yet they did it anyway. It made no geopolitical sense, but it made commercial sense. War, after all, is a business, a very lucrative one. It is why we spent 2 decades in Afghanistan, although there were near universal consensus, after a few years of fruitless fighting, that we had waded into a quagmire we could never win. In a classified diplomatic cable obtained and released by WikiLeaks, dated February 1, 2008, written from Moscow and addressed to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, NATO-European Union Cooperative, National Security Council, Russia-Moscow Political Collective, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of State, there was an unequivocal understanding that expanding NATO risked an eventual conflict with Russia, especially over Ukraine. The cable reads, "Not only does Russia perceive encirclement by NATO and efforts to undermine Russia's influence in the region, but it also fears unpredictable and uncontrolled consequences which would seriously affect Russian security interests. Experts tell us that Russia is particularly worried that the strong divisions in Ukraine over NATO membership, with much of the ethnic Russian community against membership, could lead to a major split, involving violence or, at worst, civil war. In that eventuality, Russia would have to decide whether to intervene, a decision Russia does not want to have to face." Dmitry Trenin, deputy director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, expressed concern that Ukraine was, in the long term, the most potentially destabilizing factor in U.S.-Russian relations, given the level of emotion and neuralgia triggered by its quest for NATO membership. Because membership remained divisive in Ukrainian domestic politics, it created an opening for Russian intervention. Trenin expressed concern that elements within the Russian establishment would be encouraged to meddle, stimulating U.S. overt encouragement of opposing political forces, and leaving the U.S. and Russia in a classic confrontational posture. The Obama administration, not wanting to further inflame tensions with Russia, blocked arms sales to Kyiv. But this act of prudence was abandoned by the Trump and Biden administrations. Weapons from the U.S. and Great Britain are pouring into Ukraine, part of the $1.5 billion in promised military aid. The equipment includes hundreds of sophisticated javelins and NLAW anti-tank weapons, despite repeated protests by Moscow. The United States and its NATO allies have no intention of sending troops to Ukraine. Rather, they will flood the country with weapons, which is what they did in the 2008 conflict between Russia and Georgia. Bog down Russian forces with Ukrainian corpses. The conflict in Ukraine echoes the novel Chronicle of a Death Foretold by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. In the novel, it is acknowledged by the narrator that there had never been a death more foretold, and yet no one was able or willing to stop it. All of us who reported from Central and Eastern Europe in 1989 knew the consequences of provoking Russia, and yet few have raised their voices to halt the madness. The methodical steps towards war took on a life of their own, moving us like sleepwalkers towards disaster. Once NATO expanded into Central and Eastern Europe, the Clinton administration promised Moscow that NATO combat troops would not be stationed there, the defining issue of the 1997 Founding Act on Mutual Relations, Cooperation, and Security between NATO and the Russian Federation. This promise, again, turned out to be a lie. Then, in 2014, the U.S. helped oust Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, who sought to build an economic alliance with Russia rather than the European Union. Of course, once integrated into the European Union, as seen in the rest of Central and Eastern Europe, the next step is integration into NATO. Russia, spooked by the 2014 U.S. intervention in Ukraine, alarmed at the overtures by the EU and NATO, then annexed Crimea, largely populated by Russian speakers. And the death spiral that led us to the conflict currently underway in Ukraine became unstoppable. The war state needs enemies to sustain itself. When an enemy can't be found, an enemy is manufactured. Putin has become, in the words of Senator Angus King, the new Hitler, out to grab Ukraine and the rest of Central and Eastern Europe. The full-throated cries for war, echoed shamelessly by the press, are justified by draining the conflict of historical context, by elevating ourselves as the saviors, and casting whomever we oppose, from Saddam Hussein to Putin, as the new Nazi leader. 3. Worthy and unworthy victims. Rulers divide the world into worthy and unworthy victims, those we are allowed to pity, such as Ukrainians enduring the hell of modern warfare, and those whose suffering is minimized, dismissed, or ignored. The terror we and our allies carry out against Iraqi, Palestinian, Syrian, Libyan, Somali, and Yemeni civilians is part of the regrettable cost of war. We, echoing the empty promises from Moscow, claim we do not target civilians. Rulers always paint their militaries as humane, there to serve and protect. Collateral damage happens, but it is regrettable. This lie can only be sustained among those who are unfamiliar with the explosive ordnance and large kill zones of missiles, iron fragmentation bombs, mortar, artillery and tank shells, and belt-fed machine guns. This bifurcation into worthy and unworthy victims, as Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky point out in Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, is a key component of propaganda, especially in war. The Russian-speaking population in Ukraine, to Moscow, are worthy victims. Russia is their savior. The millions of Ukrainian families cowering in basements and subways or forced to flee Ukraine are unworthy victims. Ukrainian fighters are condemned as Nazis. Worthy victims allow citizens to see themselves as empathetic, compassionate, and just. Worthy victims are an effective tool to demonize the aggressor. They are used to obliterate nuance and ambiguity. Mention the provocations carried out by the Western alliance, and you are dismissed as a Putin apologist. It is to taint the sainthood of the worthy victims, and, by extension, ourselves. We are good. They are evil. Worthy victims are used not only to express sanctimonious outrage, but to stoke self-adulation and a poisonous nationalism. The cause becomes sacred, a religious crusade. Fact-based evidence is abandoned, as it was during the calls to invade Iraq. Charlatans, liars, con artists, fake defectors, and opportunists become experts, used to fuel the conflict. Celebrities, who, like the powerful, carefully orchestrate their public image, pour out their hearts to worthy victims. Hollywood stars such as George Clooney made trips to Darfur to denounce the war crimes being committed by Khartoum, at the same time the U.S. was killing scores of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. The war in Iraq was as savage as the slaughter in Darfur, but to express outrage at what was happening to unworthy victims was to become branded as the enemy. Saddam Hussein's attacks on the Kurds after the first Gulf War were considered worthy victims, while Israeli persecution of the Palestinians, subjected to relentless bombing campaigns by the Israeli Air Force, artillery, and tank units with hundreds of dead and wounded, were a footnote. At the height of Stalin's purges in the 1930s, Worthy victims were the Republicans battling the fascists in the Spanish Civil War. Soviet citizens were mobilized to send aid and assistance. Unworthy victims were the millions of people Stalin sent to the gulags, sometimes after tawdry show trials, and executed. While I was reporting from El Salvador in 1984, the Catholic priest Jerzy Popiełuszko was murdered by the regime in Poland. His death was used to excoriate the Polish communist government, a stark contrast to the response of the Reagan administration to the rape and murder of four Catholic missionaries in 1980 in El Salvador by the Salvadoran National Guard. President Ronald Reagan's administration sought to blame the three nuns and a layworker for their own deaths. Jean Kirkpatrick, Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations, said, "The nuns were not just nuns. The nuns were also political activists." Secretary of State Alexander Haig speculated that perhaps they ran a roadblock. For the Reagan administration, the murdered churchwomen were unworthy victims. The right-wing government in El Salvador, armed and backed by the United States, joked at the time, "As patria mata un cura." Be a patriot, kill a priest. Archbishop Oscar Romero had been assassinated in March of 1980. 9 years later, the Salvadoran regime would gun down six Jesuits and two others at their residence on the campus of Central American University in San Salvador. Between 1977 and 1989, death squads and soldiers killed 13 priests in El Salvador. It is not that worthy victims do not suffer, nor that they are not deserving of our support and compassion. It is that worthy victims alone are rendered human, people like us, and unworthy victims are not. It helps, of course, when, as in Ukraine, they are white. But the missionaries murdered in El Salvador were also white and American, and yet it was not enough to shake U.S. support for the country's military dictatorship. The mass media never explain why Andrei Sakharov is worthy and José Luis Macera in Uruguay is unworthy, Herman and Chomsky write. They continue. The attention and general dichotomization occur naturally as a result of the working of the filters, but the result is the same as if a commissar had instructed the media, concentrate on the victims of enemy powers and forget about the victims of friends. Reports of the abuses of worthy victims not only pass through the filters, they may also become the basis of sustained propaganda campaigns. If the government or corporate community and the media feel that a story is useful as well as dramatic, they focus on it intensively and use it to enlighten the public. This was true, for example, of the shooting down by the Soviets of the Korean Airlines Flight 007 in early September 1983, which permitted an extended campaign of denigration of an official enemy and greatly advanced Reagan administration arms plans. As Bernard Gwertzman noted complacently in the New York Times of August 31, 1984, U.S. officials assert that worldwide criticism of the Soviet handling of the crisis has strengthened the United States in its relations with Moscow. In sharp contrast, the shooting down by Israel of a Libyan civilian airliner in February 1973 led to no outcry in the West, no denunciations for cold-blooded murder, and no boycott. This difference in treatment was explained by the New York Times precisely on the grounds of utility in a 1973 editorial. No useful purpose is served by an acrimonious debate over the assignment of blame for the downing of a Libyan airliner in the Sinai Peninsula last week. There was a very useful purpose served by focusing on the Soviet act, and a massive propaganda campaign ensued. It is impossible to hold those responsible for war crimes accountable if worthy victims are deserving of justice and unworthy victims are not. If Russia should be crippled with sanctions for invading Ukraine, which I believe it should, the United States should have been crippled with sanctions for invading Iraq, a war launched based on lies and fabricated evidence. Imagine if America's largest banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, were cut off from the international banking system. Imagine if our oligarchs, Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, Bill Gates, and Elon Musk, as venal as Russian oligarchs, had their assets frozen and estates and luxury yachts seized. Bezos' yacht is the largest in the world, costs an estimated $500 million, and is about 57 feet longer than a football field. Imagine if leading political figures, such as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and U.S. oligarchs, were blocked from traveling under visa restrictions. Imagine if the world's biggest shipping lines suspended shipments to and from the United States. Imagine if U.S. international media news outlets were forced off the air. Imagine if we were blocked from purchasing spare parts for our commercial airlines, and our passenger jets were banned from European airspace. Imagine if our athletes were barred from hosting or participating in international sporting events. Imagine if our symphony conductors and opera stars were forbidden from performing unless they denounced the Iraq War, and, in a kind of perverted loyalty oath, condemned George W. Bush. The rank hypocrisy is stunning. Some of the same officials that orchestrated the invasion of Iraq, who under international law are war criminals for carrying out a preemptive war, are now chastising Russia for its violation of international law. The U.S. bombing campaign of Iraqi urban centers, called Shock and Awe, saw the dropping of 3,000 bombs on civilian areas that killed more than 7,000 non-combatants in the first 2 months of the war. I have argued that when you invade a sovereign nation, that is a war crime, Harris Faulkner, a Fox News host, said, with a straight face, to Condoleezza Rice, who served as Bush's national security advisor during the Iraq War. It is certainly against every principle of international law and international order, and that is why throwing the book at them now in terms of economic sanctions and punishments is also a part of it, Rice said. And I think the world is there. Certainly NATO is there. He's managed to unite NATO in ways that I didn't think I would ever see after the end of the Cold War. Rice inadvertently made a case for why she should be put on trial with the rest of Bush's enablers. She famously justified the invasion of Iraq by stating, "The problem here is that there will always be some uncertainty about how quickly he can acquire nuclear weapons, but we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud." Her rationale for preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression, is no different than that peddled by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who says the Russia invasion is being carried out to prevent Ukraine from obtaining nuclear weapons. Only rarely is this hypocrisy exposed, as when U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield told The Body, "We've seen videos of Russian forces moving exceptionally lethal weaponry into Ukraine, which has no place on the battlefield. That includes cluster munitions and vacuum bombs, which are banned under the Geneva Convention." Hours later, the official transcript of her remark was amended to tack on the words, "if they are directed against civilians." This is because the U.S., which, like Russia, never ratified the Convention on Cluster Munitions Treaty, regularly uses cluster munitions. It used them in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Iraq. It has provided them to Saudi Arabia for use in Yemen. Russia has yet to come close to the tally of civilian deaths from cluster munitions delivered by the U.S. military. And this brings me to RT America, where I had a show called On Contact. RT America is now off the air after being deplatformed and unable to disseminate its content. This was long the plan of the U.S. government. The invasion of Ukraine gave Washington the opening to shut RT down. The network had a tiny media footprint, but it gave a platform to American dissidents who challenged corporate capitalism, imperialism, war, and the American oligarchy. My public denunciation of the invasion of Ukraine was treated very differently by RT America than my public denunciation of the Iraq War was treated by my former employer, The New York Times. RT America made no comment, publicly or privately, about my condemnation of the invasion of Ukraine in my Sheer Post column, nor did RT comment about statements by Jesse Ventura, a Vietnam veteran and former Minnesota governor, who also had a show on RT America, and who wrote, 20 years ago, I lost my job because I opposed the Iraq War and the invasion of Iraq. Today, I still stand for peace. As I've said previously, I oppose this war, this invasion, and if standing up for peace costs me another job, so be it. I will always speak out against war." RT America was shut down 6 days after I denounced the invasion of Ukraine. If the network had continued, Ventura and I might have paid with our jobs, but at least for those 6 days.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?